And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial and the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. We're continuing our interview with Professor Tim Anderson, author of The Dirty War on Syria, which you can pick up at globalresearch.ca. We just want to finish up because we want to expand on some of the implications, some of the bigger issues surrounding Syria. So thanks again for joining us today, Professor Anderson.
Thanks, Brendan. Yeah.
That was great. Everyone liked your interview. Really informative. And we just wanted to borrow your expertise, I guess, just to look at some of the bigger things that this all relates to. Now, in Chapter 6, you know, you had mentioned or really expounded on the idea that wars today are not simply military operations. There's a military component, obviously, that's extremely important, but there's also a substantial propaganda component. And the U.S. doesn't go ahead without that propaganda component. And so you looked at all the ways in which this is enforced, including through human rights organizations, NGO discourse, and things like that. One of the organizations you focus on is the White Helmets. Now, I mean, that sounds nice, right? I mean, White Helmets, it sounds like, you know, dashing people that run into a burning building and rescue children and all that. But you've looked into this. I mean, this is one of the newer groups. Who are the White Helmets?
Yes, I suppose the propaganda war has always been around, but I guess it's become more intense in the digital age. And we have a proliferation of NGOs, some of them actually with people on the ground and some of them virtual organizations, basically, or cyber organizations. The White Helmets, you mentioned, were set up literally in Wall Street by a foundation group called Purpose, linked into Avaaz, which started from other online organizations like the Syria Campaign. But there is also, in the case of the White Helmets, there is also a branch in Syria and organized by an ex-military US guy who effectively, if you look at their videos, it's effectively giving jackets with the logo of White Helmets to people in the armed groups. So, for example, when there was a bombing of Douma in northeast Damascus countryside some months ago, there was a video of supposedly showing all of the people injured by this government bombing, and they were all males of fighting age, let's say, chanting Islamist slogans, and a number of them had white helmet jackets on. Now, those people in Douma, we know that they'd been there for several years, were the official al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra, combined with the Army of Islam and Ahrar al-Sham. So effectively, these people were posing as civilians. They'd been doing that since the beginning of the crisis in 2011, putting their fighter casualties up as civilians. But in this case, they were doing it with the logo, if you like, or perhaps they saw some sort of protection in it, of a U.S. Wall Street-created organization. So there's really been quite a proliferation of these sorts of organizations, and the idea of the White Helmets was that here were people providing medical aid to those who were suffering the attacks of their own government, and I suppose serving as, one, a conduit for money, possibly a conduit for mobile clinics for the fighters themselves, but principally a propaganda arm for the attacks on Syria.
Yes, it's a very sophisticated mechanism by which these groups operate, in which there's a lot of revolving doors between government and human rights organizations, between human rights organizations and mainstream corporate media. And often these kind of things are carefully coordinated. You had mentioned that a PR firm, Wall Street, was involved. I think I saw on Twitter a graphic showing that one of these PR firms boasted that the White Helmets were its own personal creation. So that said, you know, we're a New York-based PR firm, and here's our creation, the White Helmets. So that's pretty shocking. But there's also more established organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, and you really focused on Human Rights Watch in terms of their approach, because it's easy to talk about violations of human rights or casualties and victims when a war occurs. But you've noticed that Human Rights Watch doesn't seem to focus on violations of the UN Charter. They're more about violations of human rights as defined from outside occurring within a country's borders. So if the United States or allied countries invade the sovereignty of another country like Syria, Human Rights Watch is going to focus on civilians that are killed during a government's campaign to remove outside forces. So that seems to be quite a skewed approach.
That's true. Human Rights Watch, let's remember, you go back to the history, it was created in the late 70s under a Democrat administration in the US, under the Jimmy Carter administration, and it was called Helsinki Watch. It was intended to draw attention to the supposed human rights violations of the then Soviet Union. So it was created in a Cold War context, aligned with Washington, but really it's remained aligned with the Democrat side of politics. So, for example, you did see Human Rights Watch during the invasion of Iraq being critical of the Bush administration, but you won't find Human Rights Watch under the Obama administration criticizing U.S. policy hardly at all, basically. It's really been in lockstep with the State Department, and certainly in relation to Syria, there's been no difference at all. It's really been an echo chamber for Washington policy.
Now, in your book, in Chapter 6, as part of this discussion, you also discussed the decline of Al Jazeera as it was once seen as something of an independent outlet or something that brought something different to the table. But with the war on Libya and then Syria, it took on the position of the Qatari monarchy and many journalists resigned. It's a very interesting section that I encourage readers to look at, because we're in a rapidly changing world here. And you have the introduction of other human rights groups like Avaaz, which came under some scrutiny for you as well. So I encourage people to read that. Looking at the implications of international law and all of that, you took the chapter 9 to talk about responsibility to protect. And that's something the listeners of this program are familiar with, because we've focused on it in the past. And you start by mentioning that it clashes with the United Nations state system of sovereignty that was established after World War II. What I found interesting is that you pointed out it was somewhat extraordinary that this idea of the responsibility to protect was rolled out just a couple of years after George Bush's invasion of Iraq. So after Bush illegally destroyed a whole country in front of the world, you already had academics hard at work creating a framework to justify more U.S. intervention. I mean, why do you think that is?
It's because of the contradictions of the post-World War II era. You know, we've had a UN charter and an International Bill of Rights, which are founded on the self-determination of nations and with human rights, the self-determination of peoples. And sovereignty and non-intervention are central to that, and most of the developing countries stress that. Most of the Western countries don't, because the idea of self-determination of peoples as a founding principle of human rights wasn't there. So the world order, the international system of international law that we have in the last 70 or so years is quite a hostile environment to old-school imperialism. So old-school imperialism can't be spoken of in quite the same sort of way. Now, humanitarian intervention has been around for a much longer time. It was spoken of by liberals in the 19th century, for example. But the specific legal construction of an idea, in this case called responsibility to protect, is an attempt to align that humanitarian intervention with the contemporary scenario of international law. It doesn't change international law at all. It's an attempt to talk about outside intervention in a way that is normally prohibited under international law. So that's why the Western powers, I guess, have been wrestling with this, attempting to find the way around that dilemma that they're faced with. Now, in the case of Iraq, the cards, if you like, were more on the table. In the case of what I call dirty wars, that is to say wars run through proxy armies, where there are dishonest, as dishonest veneer of the pretext for that war. I mean, you could say that with the invasion of Iraq, for example, there was also a pretext. The pretext was of disarmament, that there was an imminent threat to countries, including, I think, Britain said they could be under attack within 45 minutes from these weapons of mass destruction. So there was a pretext there, as there has to be in every contemporary war of aggression. But the idea of responsibility to protect was also building on another myth. I don't really think we have time to go into it now. The myth that the Western powers did not intervene strongly enough when there were serious crimes occurring in countries like Rwanda, for example, or the Balkans. So it's built on a contemporary, it's put humanitarian intervention from the 19th century into the 21st century context, I guess you can say.
That's a major theme underlying the whole second half of your book, bringing back 19th century ideas of, you know, predominantly white and Western countries fixing and solving problems in other places by removing and changing the old United Nations framework that's supposed to still hold, where states have sovereignty and there's a sort of democratic system at the United Nations. So you've shown the attempts to undermine that. It's very interesting. And this discussion of sovereignty and the responsibility to protect and international law ties to your earlier chapter about the human rights groups and the NGOs, because I think you've pointed out throughout the book a number of incidents and massacres in Syria which were not what they appeared to be, or they were not the way that they were portrayed over here. And if the United States sets up what they call red lines for intervention, including humanitarian incidents, then that basically creates an incentive for anti-government groups in the conflict to basically create a pretext of some sort to bring in foreign military forces, right? So these NGOs and human rights groups work in tandem with the responsibility to protect interventionist agenda to bypass countries' borders.
Yes, I think, and that's the great danger of this new situation, that if those al-Qaeda groups can commit massacres with impunity, blaming them on the government, with the assurance that the Western governments and their tame media will simply repeat those false accusations, it gives enormous encouragement to those groups to keep on committing those shocking crimes with the connivance of the Western powers. I try to make this point in that chapter on the responsibility to protect. It serves to encourage those sorts of crimes because they know that they won't be accountable, and it will add to the demonization of their enemy and possibly attract greater military intervention. But in my view, it's an aggravation of the war crimes that have been going on through this conflict.
Mm-hmm. Now, those sectarian groups that you mentioned, you devote a whole chapter, chapter 11, to Washington terrorism and ISIS, and you really start to roll back all the veneer and the last 5 years of reporting and ask what's going on. There's been this idea put forward that Washington's intervention in the Middle East has created a tremendous resentment, especially in Sunni regions, and that's probably true, but it obscures the role of the U.S. When it sees these extremist groups and sectarian politics as a tool or lever to reshape that region. So I'm wondering if you can tell us how the United States views sectarianism and extremism as a way to reshape and remake the Middle East.
Well, it's really been since the Iranian Revolution of the late 70s that this card has been used, the Sunni-Shia card. It wasn't a notable feature. Well, there have been some sectarians in the past, but it had never been the idea of some sort of regional war going on over sectarian religion prior to recent times. And the U.S. has very skillfully used the Saudis, who were the masters of creating the sectarian ideology, basically Wahhabism, which is the root of ISIS and al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, to try and divide the Arab and Muslims peoples. And they've successfully done it effectively in recent times, but the Syrian war has started to reverse that, really. You can see plenty of features of plurality and regional solidarity, for example, that have nothing to do with that. Iran, for example, is sometimes said by Western theorists to represent some sort of sectarian tradition in the Middle East because it's a majority Shia country against Sunni Islam. But Iran is mainly demonized because of the armed assistance it's given to the Palestinians. And there's virtually no Shia Muslim Palestinians. So that cuts across that Sunni-Shia narrative. It's something that's quite embedded in U.S. military doctrine, too, to try and use what they once called a Persian-Arab divide, in the sense of trying to separate Iranian ethnic context from the Arab peoples there. And later on, they settled on this idea of a Sunni-Shia conflict. But it's essentially a manufactured thing. I mean, it isn't. ISIS doesn't spring organically from majority Muslim communities. It's something that's very specifically created and recruited by the major allies of the U.S. in the region, the Saudis, Qatar, and Turkey, for example. And similarly, the resentment at U.S. presence in the Middle East isn't by no means limited to Sunni Muslim population. All of the populations, including the Christian and all of the others, the Druze, the Armenians and so on, have that sort of resentment. I mean, it's very clear there's been opinion polls done by many organisations, including British and North American organisations. So the attempt to wrongly link Sunni Muslims with ISIS is a part of this scam that's going on.
Right. I mean, these are armed groups that receive so much money, training, and weaponry from outside, so many fighters coming in from outside that have to be coordinated. It's not just some local organic product of resentment. There has to be a lot of deliberate effort to stoke this. But ultimately, this foreign intervention in Syria, the Saudi support for these groups, Turkey serving as a conduit and so on, all of this foreign interference in Syria has been used to justify further intervention. The instability that the intervention creates is used to justify more intervention. And you start to take the Western left in particular and the anti-war movements to task for weakness or silence or inadequacy on these issues. Chapter 12 is all about Western intervention and the colonial mind. And I know as a fact that after the war in Iraq, many people in the anti-war movement in the Anglo countries were on the lookout for further U.S. intervention in Iraq or elsewhere. There's a lot of concern that the United States might move towards Iran, and there had been moves in that direction. But fast forward a few years after Iraq, and you have the wars on Libya and Syria, dirty wars, as you would call them. And those occurred with support from significant sections of the left, and you had a weakened anti-war movement at that time. So I guess the question I'm asking is, how do you get the Western left to support a U.S. regime change operation?
Well, I think the Western left is another story in many respects, because that's why I spent a small chapter on it in the book to talk about the history to that, and why it is that the idea of a humanitarian intervention was so appealing, even more appealing to Western liberals and leftists than it is to what's sometimes called the realists, that is to say the Bushes of the world, who have a plan and they announce it openly and they say this is in the interests of our country. The idea of liberal intervention, it seems to have a particular attraction in the Western mind, and I found it interesting to, for example, see people in other countries, colonized peoples and Latin Americans. They understand dirty war very well, but it has been a particular problem, it remains, I believe, a particular challenge for the Western left, who I believe adopt many of the cultural ideas of colonial culture, colonial and neocolonial culture. That is to say, other people are effectively people that can be rescued, but they're helpless agents. They don't actually have their own agency. And similarly, that the Western left has this view of the state as essentially a monolithic captured beast of the elite that can never represent the people in some sort of way, whereas in the post-colonial world, the state does in many respects, despite many betrayals and many bad experiences, represent potentially a vindication, a representation of popular will, for example. So the post-colonial world, for example, countries that were colonies, had Fidel Castro's and Nelson Mandela's and Hugo Chavez and Salvador Allende's, all these Ho Chi Minh's, these sorts of people. We didn't have that in Western cultures. It wasn't the same. So we don't see the state in the same sort of way. So when a clever Western administration demonizes another people through their state, calling them a dictatorship or killing their own people or whatever, it sort of rings a bell for us Westerners, because we're used to our states being alienated from our states and seeing them do horrendous things in the name of their own interests.
Absolutely. I mean, Canadians and Australians have never had to free ourselves from some kind of alien external power that colonized and dominate us. You know, the United States had its revolution against British domination way back in 1776. So the use of the state to protect a people against colonization, the use of sovereignty to protect from colonialism, those are experiences in the global South, but they don't resonate so much here in the West. So there's a lot of people that just don't understand why other countries like Venezuela or Syria or Cuba or Iran might want to use the state to protect themselves. So here, our left knows how to ritualistically demonize the state or call for the overthrow of all states. So I guess when the U.S. media says that there's some bad state that has to go, like Syria, we just adopt that terminology, or a lot of people just jump on that bandwagon.
Yeah, as I said, I think it's quite deep, and that it goes into something that we as Westerners have to examine. I mean, we all have our particular histories of it. You know, Canada and Australia have their different histories in terms of Indigenous peoples. The U.S. has its own history of the largest slave system on Earth and the Indigenous, the Native Americans. If you look, for example, at the U.S. history there, it's rooted in the fact that the American Revolution was really was not about the liberation of the slaves. It was complaining about the limits put on the ethnic cleansing of the Native American people. So there are particular features of our own colonial histories which we have to come to terms with and have a look and see to what extent they still affect the thinking of people, not just the state, not just the so-called nationalists, but the left also.
Now, we're just heading into a new phase of the struggle in Syria. I think you had an article recently on global research. There's been a big push by the Syrian government, allied with Russia, to remove these various insurgent groups. But now it looks like Turkey is becoming more belligerent, and it seems to believe it has a stake in this conflict, that it should be able to have forces operating inside Syria or support groups inside Syria. And the Saudis have been escalating too, and they say they want to move military units, you know, into Syria. So now that the government seems to have things moving on its side or having momentum going its way, there's been a heightening of the opposition elements from outside. Is Syria in greater danger, or, you know, I mean, we have the possibility of a large escalation. So how do you see things potentially going forward, or what challenges is the country facing?
Yes, it's true that the Russian alliance with, let's remember, the very powerful ground army that Syria has assembled with the help of all of its major neighbours, Iran, Iraq, and the better part of Lebanon, is everyone recognises that there's been a big shift in that military side of things. And the belligerent noises coming from Turkey and Saudi are clearly because they see it too. They see themselves, they see defeat, and they don't really want to contemplate defeat. They didn't imagine they could be defeated in this sort of way. And so they're talking things up, in my view, but the critical factor is what level of outside support are they going to have. Turkey has often assumed that NATO would support them in some sort of way, but that's by no means guaranteed if it's a very clear aggression against Syria. Similar with the Saudis. The Saudis have no real capacity if they don't have backup from the US. Of course, all of this use of mainly US weapons to arm ISIS and the other groups has been through those groups, and clearly, to anyone who knows how US exports weapons, it's clearly been with the approval of the US, because the US actually has a specific office set up to prevent the re-export of its weapons, or to license the re-export of its weapons. So any of the armed groups that Turkey and the Saudis are providing arms to is clearly known by the US. But there's one level of deception that's hiding that from the general public there. But I think the key issue here is, Brendan, that whether the US really wants escalation, and I don't believe it does. I think the Obama administration has been trying to get out of that, and I think any new administration would also want to get out of this losing war. The US doesn't like to lose a war, but it certainly doesn't want to escalate for no reason at all when it sees no prospect of success. So therein lies a dilemma for Turkey and the Saudis talking things up. They can't go in without the US backing or they'll be destroyed effectively. I mean, that's precisely what happened to the British and the French when they took on Nasser back in the 50s. If you remember the Suez Crisis, the US decided not to back them up. It happened to the Georgian Prime Minister, President, back in some years back when he took on the Russians over some breakaway provinces, and even George W. Bush wouldn't back him up. So I don't think there is a mood in Washington to escalate the situation now, and I think we have to read the saber rattling and, to some extent, the bombing coming from Turkey and the Saudis in that light. And there is some evidence already that they're backing down from that position, because clearly they're getting signals from Washington that if they escalate the situation and confront that combined ground army and the Russians that the U.S. is not going to come and rescue them.
I hope rationality wins the day. I guess we'll see in the next 2 months or so how this all unfolds. But I know you got to run. But Professor Anderson, thanks so much for giving us your time in Australia. We'll get this out there to people. And after the interview, I'll again mention where people can find the book. So thanks very much for being on the program with us today.
Thank you, Brendan.